Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Before we begin, I want to give a big thanks to Real Clear Religion for mentioning us every week on their news aggregator. RealClearReligion.org is a great one-stop shopping place for all your religious news. And when they highlight us, it brings a lot of you to us. And so we really appreciate that. We also want to thank all the folks who've been emailing us. And in the past week, we've gotten a number of different emails congratulating us on some of our recent podcasts, the ones on religious minorities in the United States, on Judaism and Sikhism. And so we want to thank you for that. I do this program out of a labor of love, and I don't receive any compensation for it. So you could say it's a hobby of mine. And when I get these emails from listeners, it really warms my heart and helps to keep me going. So thank you very much. And if you do want to reach out again and contact us, you can call us or email us at tgill@uw.edu. And of course, you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at links on our site. All right. I am very, 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 very excited today for the show. My guest is Michael Foley, an associate professor of patristics in the Great Text program at Baylor University. He is a prodigious author on many fronts, including scholarly articles, over 150 essays and reviews in places such as First Things, the Latin Mass, and the Wall Street Journal, and he's written a number of books, including St. Augustine's Confessions, Why Do Catholics Eat Fish on Friday? The Catholic Origin of Just About Everything, and Wedding Rites, a complete guide to traditional vows, music, ceremonies, blessings, and interfaith services. All of that is well and good, but his most recent book is what really caught my attention and is the topic for today, and that work is entitled Drinking with the Saints, A Sinner's Guide to Holy Happy Hour, just released by Regnery Press. When he is not writing, Professor Foley can be seen and heard on numerous radio and television programs such as EWTN Live and Bookmark with Doug Kreck. His full biography and links to his books, as well as a link to the website that is connected with his new book, Drinking with the Saints, can be found at our website. And if you are all very good, we just might post one or two cocktail recipes from his new book over at our Facebook site. So please join us there. Yes, his book actually does have drink recipes, and we may cover some of those here. Don't forget, we're on Twitter as well, so help us get to 500 Twitter followers by the end of the week, and we would be greatly appreciative of that. Mike, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Before we saddle up to the bar and start sipping from your new book, I have to ask a few questions. I noted in your biography that I just mentioned above that you wrote St. Augustine's Confessions. Now, I've always suspected that work was ghostwritten, so now we know who really wrote it, don't we?
Well, I wish I could take credit, but St. Augustine wrote his Confessions, and I simply edited one of the English translations.
So what's involved in that? I'm always curious because I will see St. Augustine's Confessions or I will see Thomas Aquinas's different works and people will have their name attached to them. So what goes on in doing that? Do you rewrite it the way that you want to or what?
Well, I don't change the wording at all, either of the original text or of the translation. In this case, I simply made sure there were no typos in the text and then added 1,700 endnotes to the confessions.
Wow. Well, now, what's all in those endnotes? I mean, one of the things that always puzzles me is that when you read the epistles of Paul and then go into your pastor's office, you see about five shelves of books about commentary on the epistles of Paul, which are, you know, 5,000 times longer than anything Paul ever wrote. And I always kind of scratch my head and I say, man, didn't they all just write it nice and pithy before? So what's in these footnotes?
Yes, well, I don't do anything quite that voluminous, but Augustine, for example, quotes scripture on almost every page of the Confessions, almost every paragraph. And so this would just be a citation from, you know, what scriptural passage he's citing.
Okay, so that's kind of neat. It helps to fill in and round it out for us readers in the contemporary era that might have missed some of the things that were inside baseball talk, I guess, back then.
Exactly. There are a lot of contemporary references that his audience would have understood that ours wouldn't get. So sometimes a historical explanation, short one, is necessary.
The other thing that I want to note about your biography is that prior to coming to Baylor, which, by the way, is a Baptist university, you taught at Boston College, Jesuit, and Notre Dame, Holy Cross. Both of those are Catholic. Now, I just want to note that because we're coming up to the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. And I just want to know if your move down to Waco was in any way associated with that, or was that just a coincidence?
Well, and the further irony is that in some ways I'm more free to be a Catholic theologian at Baylor than I was at Boston College or Notre Dame.
Hmm. So you are a Catholic theologian,
yep.
But you are a and you still are. I'm sure the Baptists are working on you down there. You know, okay. But and their football team is doing pretty darn good too, so that might be a divine sign, I don't know. But yeah, it is kind of nice because Baylor does provide a great deal of freedom of religion and ecumenical cross dialogue, and that's what we're kind of doing here today too. Sounds
fun. That's right.
Well, let's get down to that, less small talk, and let's get to the heart of the matter here and talk about this new book, Drinking with the Saints, which Regnery Press is advertising as, quote, one part bartender's guide and one part spiritual manual, unquote. I would say shake well and bookmark it with a twist of lime. So there we have it. What could, you're a scholar. You're a scholar of patristics, the old church fathers and stuff like that. Whatever possessed you to write a book on booze?
Well, I guess it's my twin love of the Catholic faith and the drink.
Ah, I see. He loves the Catholic faith and the drink. But as some of you might know, and maybe I'm sure you know as well, Baylor, affiliated with Southern Baptist, and as such is a dry campus. So have you gotten any pushback from administrators or from some of your other colleagues about writing a book on booze?
Well, as far as I know, the administration doesn't know about it yet. So you may have to do a follow-up interview with me to see if there's any blowback. But no, my colleagues have always been very supportive. Even the ones who don't drink themselves find it an amusing idea. One of my colleagues says that the only difference between Baptists and Catholics is that Catholics drink on the front porch and Baptists drink on the back porch.
Oh, I got to use that. I got to use that. I like that. Very interesting, because I know in some cases that it might be very true. I should also note, too, that we've had another Baylor professor on, Barry Hankins, who did write about religion and alcohol in his book entitled Jesus and Gin, and we'll link back to that podcast. He was dealing a little bit more with the lead-up to Prohibition and the Prohibition era, but nonetheless, the spirits were involved in that book as well. Now, one of the things that you do with this book, and by the way, I want to tell listeners out there that this book is really fun to read. There's so many different dimensions of this book that there's something for everybody here. Because one of the things you do is you provide lesser-known recipes for drinks and create some of your own. And so we're going to get to some of those favorites at the end of this interview. So you all have to keep listening. But it's also a book, you know, again, about alcohol. And the immediate question that comes up is that, was this thing designed to celebrate and promote debauchery?
Oh, not at all. Drinking with the Saints promotes only the very best kind of drinking, which is drinking in moderation.
Hmm.
And that's true not only because it's the morally responsible thing to do, but also simply because it's the most pleasurable thing to do. When you drink immoderately, it becomes less pleasant. Drinking in moderation is the way to really slow down and enjoy what you're doing, as well as being obviously the morally right thing to do.
That is true, because if you do not drink in moderation, the next morning is a little bit troublesome.
That's right.
Yeah. Not that
many consequences for sin.
Yeah, not that I would know, but I have heard. I
have
heard.
Same here.
And it's true, too. We're going to talk a lot about different types of alcohol today and their relationship to different saints, to different periods of the liturgical calendar, as well as their different flavors, which is always kind of nice. And as you say, drinking in moderation and just enjoying this is one wonderful experience. But it's not just the alcohol itself, but there's also the fellowship that oftentimes comes with sharing a drink. Just as we share a meal with others, it's sharing a drink with folks.
Absolutely. And that definitely is one of the aims of drinking with the saints, is to promote that kind of convivial fellowship.
Mm-hmm. And it does that tremendously well. And it's a book that you're going to want to share with your friends. Again, I can't stop raving about this book because it is really neat. And when wine after 5 years to feature something like this, and here you are releasing this tomorrow on May 4th, and that's going to be really cool. Speaking of this, religion and alcohol, there's a pretty long tradition in Judeo-Christianity of this whole topic, and it goes back to the Old Testament or the Torah. Give us some flavor for the relationship between the Judeo-Christian faith and alcohol.
Well, as you point out, there always has been a relationship. You see wine mentioned, wine and strong drink mentioned many times in both the Old and New Testament. Most of the references are favorable. Usually when there's a negative reference, it's in reference to drunkenness, the immoderate use of alcohol, not the use of alcohol per se. The very first mention of alcohol in the Bible is somewhat unfavorable. Noah plants the first vineyard, and apparently not aware of the power at his disposal, becomes drunk and passes out. So not an auspicious start, but you do see wine as an important part of Hebrew life. And then, of course, you see wine used in a very important way during the Last Supper. So overall, a favorable view. You even see St. Timothy being told by St. Paul to drink wine for his stomach problems. St. Paul sees wine and health as being related to each other. So you've got a good foundation in the Bible for appreciating wine responsibly in moderation. And then when the church starts developing, you see all new kinds of liquors being developed as well.
And who am I to ever argue with St. Paul?
That's right.
I know. That's what he's saying. Yeah. And you do this really well and go back historically and provide us with a lot of what I could call fun facts or possibly trivia answers for bar time trivia if you happen to be at a monastery that has a tavern associated with it, and they have some questions related to alcohol and religion. So give us some of these things. One of my favorite drinks is beer. What is the connection with beer and religion?
Well, usually the storybook answer is that beer was invented by the ancient Egyptians, as far as we can tell. But it really was perfected by medieval monasteries. They gave us modern brewing as we know it today, the filtration process and everything else. And to this day, the world's finest beer is made within the cloister. The Trappists, in particular, make what is considered the world's finest beer.
Yeah, I know that there are some really fine Belgian white beers that are considered or that come from some of these Trappist monasteries. And I'm basically domestic brew kind of drinker, maybe don't have the fine appreciation for this, but the monks, very good at making beer. I mean, what's the deal? Why did they make beer? Why didn't they just raise sheep or something?
Well, in part it was, I think, to raise money for their monasteries in the Middle Ages. But another big reason was health-wise. Before the days of modern water plant treatments, beer was added to water to kill waterborne pathogens. Places that drank beer, for example, would be spared from the plague or other such diseases that were carried by water. So it became actually a very important part of health, both in the Middle Ages and beyond. The nickname for bread in the Middle Ages was liquid bread because of its health-giving qualities.
You can't argue with that one either. So they're doing this for health reasons, and beer is one of the things that, again, I mentioned beer tops my list of favorite alcoholic drinks. But there are a few others as well, including champagne.
That's right. Champagne was also invented by a Benedictine monk, Dom Pérignon. The most famous champagne now bearing his name in honor of that fact. Dom Perignon invented the méthode champenoise, the method for creating sparkling wines. And according to the story, that when he sampled his first batch, he cried out to his fellow monks, "Brothers, come quickly, I'm drinking stars."
I guess you could do that. For me, champagne is a little bit hard to swallow, so to speak, because whenever I get it, whenever I drink it, I tend to get headaches. But one of my other favorite liquors, and this is my third favorite down on the list, is whiskey. And this has an interesting story related to religion as well. And what's the story with whiskey?
Well, it is believed that whiskey was invented by Irish monks. They took the recipe for aqua vitae from the continent and then applied it to local circumstances. And the word whiskey is actually the Gaelic translation for aqua vitae, which means water of life. That was a Roman phrase for strong liquor. So the Irish monks created whiskey, and they probably are the ones who shared this knowledge with the Scottish during their missions to that land. Whiskey was first prescribed medicinally as a cure for paralysis of the tongue. And apparently it works, for no Irishman since has been accused of having a paralyzed tongue.
I will vouch for that. Whiskey and loosening of the tongue, unparalyzing it, if that is a word, go hand in hand with me. And we can say that. I know you're Irish, and I have an Irish heritage too. So, yeah, that whiskey heritage. Do you have any idea what the disease of paralysis of the tongue would be? Is it just somebody who's shy?
I have no idea. Yeah. I thought that was really odd when I read it.
So, hey, yeah, loosen up. Here's some whiskey, and you'll tell all your secrets. Now, I mentioned that whiskey is my third favorite alcohol on the list, and my second favorite is rum. I already mentioned beer is the first, but one of the things, I saw occasional mentions of rum in the book. It popped up here and there, but I didn't see any particular religious story related to rum. So what's the deal? Why is that left off the list here?
Well, we definitely have a number of rum cocktails in the book.
Okay, that's important.
But as far as a liquor goes, it does not appear to have had a Catholic or specifically Christian origin. It basically began in the sugar plantations of the New World, and actually probably by the slaves. They in the Caribbean, they were the first one to sort of figure out the process.
Mm-hmm. So not associated with any religious group, but with pirates, and pirates are equally cool.
That's right. Yeah. It was quickly condemned by religious groups, especially in New England, where rum was extremely popular. It was called devil rum by the religious leaders of the time.
Yes, and you often hear the phrase demon rum coming from evangelicals up on the circuit rider circuits, I guess, there.
That's right.
Yeah, so demon rum gets a bad rap, but here in the Gill household, it ranks as number two.
All right.
Now, those are my top three. I got beer, rum, and whiskey, but you start to get into some alcohols that I'm not all that familiar with. I might have heard of some of these, but I don't know what they're all about. And one of these is called the magical liqueur. Tell me about this.
You're thinking of chartreuse.
Yes.
Chartreuse is, in my opinion, the world's best liqueur. It is bottled by the Carthusian Order in their headquarters, which is called the Charter House in the French Alps. Only two monks at any time know the recipe. It is a tightly guarded secret. About 100 years ago, the French government actually tried to steal the recipe from the monks so that the state could take over the production of chartreuse. But the monks refused to give away the recipe, and the government tried to replicate the recipe. They brought in their best botanists and best distillers to try to figure out what the recipe was, and they failed miserably.
Wait a minute, you said botanists. What does botany have to do with the making of this liquor?
Because chartreuse is made from over 130 hand-picked herbs that the monks pick from the nearby Alps.
Wow, that is pretty amazing. Now, you mentioned that you really like this. You consider it to be one of the best liqueurs, which means you must have tasted it. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. There are two versions, and there are two versions that are available in the United States. I heard there's a third version that's only available in Europe. But the two that are available in the United States are the original green chartreuse and yellow chartreuse. Yellow chartreuse is a little lighter and a little sweeter, but they're both very good. Mm-hmm. They pack a punch. Green chartreuse is, I think, about 110 proof. This is definitely something to be sipped in small amounts. And the initial taste is quite intense. It's burning, almost. But once you let it sort of glide over your tongue, you will experience a spectrum of flavors. It really is magical.
Does it taste like herbal flowers? Yeah, I'm thinking like lavender or parsley or thyme or something like that. Is there any way to possibly describe it other than magical?
Herbal.
Herbal, I guess. Okay.
You definitely can tell it's got an herbal base to it. It sort of has a sweet quality to it. You just got to taste it to know it, how good it is.
And it's a pretty interesting way to keep the secret is to have only two monks know the recipe at any given time. I am hoping that those monks are well guarded.
That's right. Well, they've been doing this for about 500 or 600 years, so okay. It's a formula that has worked.
Okay, I guess they got that down. And is it related to the color chartreuse at all?
It is indeed. It is one of the only instance where a liquor created the color rather than vice versa. So We get the name chartreuse as a color from the liquor.
And that is rather interesting to know. Now, I also have to mention that since you know what the taste is, you obviously have revealed that you have tasted it. You must have had to do a lot of research for this book.
I did. It was the best research project I've ever had.
And did you get any grant money from this? Did you call up, Jack Daniels and say, hey, I need a research grant?
I got no external funding, unfortunately.
No.
But I do remember when I first announced this idea to my wonderful wife, Alexandra, her very first response was, wonderful. That means all our booze is now tax deductible.
Oh, woohoo. And did you involve other people in the tasting of this? Was this a group project or is just this you solo? And
it was very much a group project. Not for every single drink, but we lead a social life and we have friends. And every time friends would come over, I'd have them taste different things. What do you think of that? How do you feel about this? So in my acknowledgments page, it gets rather long because there are a lot of people that I thank for their contributions.
That is very cool. This would have been one of the most interesting colloquia to attend, if you could call those colloquias, but sounds very interesting. Getting back to actually some of the liquors, there's a few other ones here that I'm not all that familiar with. One of them is Benedictine Dom. What is that? What's the story there?
That is another liqueur, Benedictine D-O-M. Which appears on every label. The DOM is an abbreviation of Deo Optimo et Maximo, to God most good and most great, which was a motto of the Benedictines. So according to the story, this particular liqueur was the creation of Benedictine monks that then passed into the hands of a secular distiller in the mid-19th century. And it's been produced by this same distiller ever since.
Hmm. And how does it taste?
Very good. It's a very sweet drink. It was extremely popular in the 30s, especially with the mixed drink of B&B, which is equal parts Benedictine and brandy.
Hmm.
So the brandy cuts the sweetness a little bit and makes it a little less overpowering. But B&B is good. Although I must confess, I prefer the B&B Plus, which is Benedictine brandy and just a little bit of lemon juice. And that adds a nice sort of citric complexity to the drink.
Mm-hmm. That's probably before they introduced Red Bull and Rockstar energy drinks.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm thinking of a Jaeger bomb here or something like this, a Benedictine Dom bomb or something. Okay, very interesting. And a monk, again, monks kind of pop up with these things all the time. And another one that you mentioned in your book is one that has a bottle shaped like a monk. What is that?
Oh, that's Frangelico.
Uh-huh.
It comes in a brown bottle shaped like a monk with a cloth cincture or belt around its waist. And according to the legend, it was invented by a hermit monk of that name, Frangelico, while he was experimenting with various nuts and herbs and berries he had gathered in his solitude.
Wow. Well, I guess you got to do something with those.
Exactly.
And how does that one taste? That must taste somewhat fruity and sweet.
I mean, it's also sweet. Yeah. The difference between a liquor and a liqueur is that a liqueur still has sugar in it, whereas a liquor has distilled off all the sugars. So a liqueur will always be sweet.
Okay.
And it is sweet. It has sort of an almond taste to it, even though I don't think it's made with almonds.
Hmm.
It's very good.
Okay. I'm not just going to take your word to that. I think I'm starting to get a taste for some of these things. So I'm going to have to stop out to the local liquor store pretty soon and engage in some of my own research here, just to make sure that we call that validation in the social scientist, right? Retesting.
That's right. And actually, Tony, now that I think about it, in the interest of accuracy, it's hazelnut I was thinking of, not almond.
Oh.
Frangelico is hazelnut. Amaretto is almond.
Yes.
There are a lot of liqueurs. It's hard to keep them all straight.
I, especially after many tastings, I can imagine.
It does wear on the brain cells.
And so a lot of these have come from Europe, but not all of them have come from Europe. And you mentioned another one that intrigues me because it's from here in the Western Hemisphere and sounds like one of my other favorite drinks, which is eggnog. And you call this, or it is called Rompope. What is Rompope?
Yes, and it is, for lack of a better description, a kind of a Mexican eggnog. It's sort of creamy and yellowy and tasty the way that eggnog is tasty. But it comes complete in a bottle, and unlike our eggnog, you don't need to keep it refrigerated. You can just sort of keep the bottle out, and it will last. It was invented by nuns in Mexico when Mexico was still a Spanish colony. It was these nuns of the convent of Santa Clara. And to this day, there is a Santa Clara Rompope that is made.
Very fascinating. And Santa Clara meaning Santa Clara, California, correct?
No, actually. Oh. It was a convent of Santa Clara somewhere in Mexico. It wasn't the name of the city. It was the name of the convent.
Okay. I guess there probably can be many Santa Claras location-wise. So,
exactly.
Yeah, I understand. So does it really taste like eggnog, or is it not quite eggnog?
That's the nearest comparison I can give it. I may be offending some Rompope aficionados by making that comparison, but it is a really good drink. We actually used it to make an original cocktail in honor of Santa Clara, St. Clair, called a frozen Clarice. We sort of made it almost into an ice cream dessert drink.
Whoa. Now you're hitting home with me. I love ice cream. I love dessert, and I love drinks.
This is a good one.
Ugh. Okay, we said that we were going to mention some of the recipes later on, but give us a little hint of this one right now.
Well, we named it the Frozen Clarice. Clarice was a name for the nuns that St. Clair had founded. And it's Rompope, I'm trying to remember now, Rompope, Kahlua, coffee liqueur, some ice, some milk, put it all in a blender, and then you put it in a glass that's lined with chocolate syrup.
Oh, my gosh.
It's good.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. Not just good. That sounds great. I'm already tasting that. Well, bless these nuns. And these nuns in Mexico are not only the ones who are introducing alcohol around, but you also mentioned the California wine industry, dating back to its Mexican days when it was basically under Spanish colonial rule, has some connection to wine. What's going on here?
That's right. You have to recall that one of the seven sacraments in the Catholic Church is the Eucharist, and one of the things that's needed for the Eucharist is wine. So Catholic missionaries, when they spread the gospel, also had to spread a knowledge of viticulture. And so you see this in California, Argentina, Australia. Wherever Catholic missionaries went, they planted vineyards so that they could have wine to celebrate the Eucharist. And that is how the California wine industry got started.
And for me, this is just amazing because you tell a little story in the book, too, about how they would make sure that they took vines that have already been established and bring them over. It's not just bringing seeds, but it's basically bringing pieces of the plant to duplicate the flavors of different parts of the world and their wineries. And I can just imagine this for monks. I imagine they don't have very much to pack. They took vows of poverty after all, but you know, somebody's, you know, has a suitcase there saying, yeah, don't forget the robes and the rope belts. And oh, by the way, who has the vines, right?
They must have done something like that because it did spread.
Yeah. One of the other things that you do in this book that's really wonderful is that you pull quotes not only from the Bible, but from different religious thinkers throughout time and place. And one of those is J.K. Chesterton. And since he was not a Catholic to begin with, he converted to Catholicism. Why did he convert to Catholicism?
Well, the quote that's attributed to him is that he converted to Catholicism because it was the only religion that could reconcile the pipe, the pint, and the cross.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's probably not the only reason, but it sounds like a pretty good reason, if you ask me.
Well, it was an important consideration for Chesterton.
Yeah.
He had to bend the elbow.
And I can imagine, too, because one of the things that intrigued me about this book, and I guess the relation to writing this at Baylor, and Baylor's a dry campus in that, is that the other dimension of religion and alcohol that oftentimes come up is the prohibitionist movement. There are temperance movements, and a lot of evangelicals and Protestant fundamentalists really tend to have an aversion to alcohol, despite this history that you just informed us. You know, going back deep into the church, the Protestants, you know, have a lineage that goes back to some of these monasteries that we now associate with Catholicism. It obviously has a lineage to the Bible and all the references to alcohol there. So what's up with these evangelicals who are on this temperance bandwagon?
Well, on the positive side, they definitely were reacting to some really egregious abuses of alcohol. You know, apparently when gin was first introduced to England, it was like crystal meth, that it was cheap and very potent, and the lower classes were just going berserk with it, and it was causing all kinds of vice and mayhem. And similar stories happened in New England, and you get Irish and Italian immigrants to the United States, and they appear to be abusing the bottle as they live lives of poverty. So there was a reaction to that abuse. On the other hand, there clearly was an anti-Catholic animus, especially to prohibition. The drive to make alcohol illegal in the United States had a lot of backing from anti-Catholic groups that were very much opposed to the kinds of lifestyles that these papist immigrants were living.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, coming after the Irish again, I would assume.
That's right.
You know, being an Irish, you know, I have Catholicism in my background, in my family lineage, but I am now a Protestant. I decided to get on that bandwagon after about 500 years or so, but this book that you're writing, it's even though you have a lot of Catholic saints in there, this is not just aimed at Catholics, is it?
Oh, no. There's something here for everyone. It follows the Catholic liturgical calendar because there is no sort of generic Christian calendar. But I do believe that others will be able to benefit from the book.
Explain that a minute, because there are two big sections in your book, and one of them deals with the alcohol or drinks associated with the liturgical calendar. And, you know, for somebody who, you know, me, I'm not a really deep thinking theologian here. For me, the liturgical calendar is pretty basic. And to find out that there's different types of liturgical calendars, the Catholic calendar, the Lutheran calendar, the Orthodox calendar, I kind of know the Orthodox one because their Easter is always a little bit different than everybody else on the calendar. But explain this liturgical calendar thing.
Well, it's kind of like national calendars when you think about it, that every nation has its own calendar. You know, the United States has Thanksgiving on a certain date, but Canada has its Thanksgiving on a different date. Or every nation celebrates its founding on a different date. Something similar obtains with the churches. The Catholic Church keeps a certain calendar. There actually are a couple of calendars within the Catholic Church. The Lutheran Church has its, the Anglican Church, the Episcopalians. And then, you're right, the Eastern Orthodox are almost on a completely different field because they're following a different calendar in a more profound sense. They're following the old Julian calendar of Julius Caesar rather than the Gregorian calendar, which the rest of the West is following. Mm-hmm. So that makes even more variation. They're having Easter at a different date and all other sorts of things.
But the neat thing about your book is that it's not just the Catholic liturgical calendar, but you cover the basics, I would say, of the Christian faith, and it's applicable to all of the faith. In fact, you know, I'm pretty much on the same calendar as most Catholics here. And so walk us through the basic Christian calendar, the basic Christian liturgical calendar, and its relationship with alcohol. And I guess we would start with Advent, right?
That would be the place to start, exactly, with the Western churches, be they Protestant or Catholic. The beginning of the liturgical year is the first Sunday of Advent. Not New Year's Day, but sometime in early December. And Advent is that period of 4 weeks preparing for Christmas, the Nativity of our Lord. And during the season of Advent, what I found was that the most traditional drink to have was something called Glühwein, which is German for glow wine. It is a hot, spiced, mulled wine to sort of warm the winter nights.
So Glühwein, when you immediately said Glühwein, I started thinking Elmer's glue, but that's not glow
wine. No, it's spelled differently too, thank goodness.
Okay. Well, we'll get that printing out there on our website so people can see it. But glow wine, that sounds pretty good. I mean, it sounds like a deep winter. It's cold outside. You're going to heat up some wine and maybe put some spices in it, right?
Exactly.
Okay. And that's a very comforting type of drink for that time of year.
Exactly.
Okay. Does that have any relationship to wassail?
Yes and no. A wassail, that's from the Anglo-Saxon word for to your health. It was actually a toast.
Oh.
A wassail is kind of like the modern equivalent of a punch. It was a large drink in a bowl that several people could drink from. It was usually in the Middle Ages based on hot mead or hot ale, and then mixed in with nuts and fruits. And it was very popular during Christmas and Epiphany. The modern punch is not based on mead or ale, but rather rum. That's one of the differences between the ancient medieval and modern punches. And then the Christmas punches are based on wine. So you've got three basic options.
Mm. So so in terms of the liturgical calendar, when we come up to Christmas, the drinks start changing a little bit to more punches.
Exactly. So you'll see a lot of recipes for Christmas punches, both cold and hot, that are wine-based.
And then, as you mentioned, some of these now are rum-based, and I'm thinking of fruits, too. That this seems to me almost to be a modern invention, because you don't, when you think deep in history and that, you don't hear much about, you know, sangria or anything like that. Are these drinks relatively new in terms of their historical development, or do they date farther back than I might be thinking?
It's tricky to know for sure. Some are very old, some are not. They say that the idea of mixed drinks is as old as drinks themselves, that from the moment that alcohol was invented, people were putting things in it to adjust the flavors. On the other hand, the idea of a cocktail really only comes into its own in the 19th century.
Hmm. And how does that come about? I guess I just have to step aside from the liturgical calendar a bit, but where does the idea of cocktails come about?
There are different theories. Some people believe that the world's first cocktail was the Sazerac, invented in New Orleans sometime before the Civil War. Other people say, no, it was with the Revolutionary War. You can even see it as early as that. You know, people have different theories about this. But it does seem to have been a more or less American invention.
Hmm.
And it definitely picked up steam by the end of the 19th century. And once you hit the 20th century, it was already in full swing.
Now, I'm learning a lot of stuff here. What is the difference between a mixed drink and a cocktail? I would probably use those terms interchangeably.
Well, and to be honest with you, in daily speech, I pretty much do as well.
Hmm.
But there is a technical difference. A mixed drink, for example, could be like mulled wine, where you take wine and you just add a couple of other ingredients, whereas in a sense, a cocktail is a more formal thing. It usually has to have at least three separate ingredients in order to be considered a cocktail. It's usually served in special glassware. There are a number of sort of subtle differences between the two.
I have a feeling we're going to come back to that special glassware here in a few moments, but I do want to move us back into the liturgical calendar. We've done Advent. We've done Christmas. I would guess the next thing that we're going to go through, at least on the major calendar, is Lent, right?
That is correct.
Well, in Lent, there must not be any alcohol because you give stuff up.
You would think, but that was not the traditional mindset. Hmm. For as we mentioned earlier, beer and other forms of alcohol, such as wine, were associated with health. And if you gave up wine and beer during Lent, you could actually be vulnerable to these sort of waterborne pathogens. So what the monks in the Middle Ages did was actually invent a particular kind of beer just for the season of Lent. This is the origin of Doppelbock, or Bock beer. And it was made during the season of Lent to have extra nutrients in order to compensate for the fast. So it was sort of a vitamin supplement during Lent.
Fortified beer.
That's right.
I gotta love that. And who am I to argue with monks?
Exactly.
And does this beer really have extra nutrients? I mean, it sounds like a health drink now. I'm gonna like drink a kale smoothie, but I mean, is there some science behind this that it really did help out?
I don't know about the science, but there was a man who put this to the test just about 3 years ago, and he was an evangelical Christian, if I remember correctly. He was not a Catholic, but he was a home brewer, and he was intrigued by this. So he got together with another brewer who was associated with a chain of restaurant bars. I can't remember the name. The details of this are in the book. And for the 40 days of Lent, he drank nothing and ate nothing but beer and water. The only thing he had during those 40 days was this special Bock beer that he had made and water. He lost 25 pounds. He never got drunk during the 40 days. He took it all in moderation. And he said it was a profoundly spiritual experience, that he understood Lent for the first time in a way that he'd never understood before.
Did he give any kind of indication of what that mystical understanding was?
Yes, he did. He wrote about it rather eloquently, and I quote him in the book. But if I remember correctly, what he basically said was he got a sense of the monk's sense of frailty and the need to renew your dependence on God.
Hmm. That is absolutely fascinating. Now, I just have to put a caveat here. Research on Religion is not advising anybody to go out and fast on beer for the next 40 days. This is just purely informational, so please don't blame us for anything if anything kind of goes wrong with this. But it is interesting, and it is something that's in the book that is an absolutely fascinating read, so you should go back and do it. So interesting experience there for Lent. Whenever I think Lent, though, and at least in contemporary modern times, I tend to think right before Lent, Mardi Gras. Now, if there's anything that's ever associated with booze, it's got to be Mardi Gras. So what is there a special story related to alcohol and Mardi Gras?
There is, actually. The whole Mardi Gras and carnival traditions come from the liturgical year. Because in the weeks prior to Lent, which begins on Ash Wednesday, people would start to wean themselves of the various foods that they would have to give up for Lent. And this was in the days before refrigeration, so they needed to sort of consume all of these forbidden foods before Ash Wednesday began, or they would spoil. So on the one hand, they're trying to become more ascetical. On the other hand, they've got all this food they got to get rid of. And that is why you get these carnival celebrations. It was an attempt to empty the larder before Lent came. And the word carnival actually is a Christian word. It doesn't mean an amusement park. A carnival literally means abstinence from meat.
I see. So you have to give all that stuff up, and you don't want to throw it away. So not surprisingly, Tuesday kind of becomes Fat Tuesday.
Exactly.
People just chewing down those last sticks of butter before Lent comes.
That's right. Yeah. When you look at some of these recipes, Mardi Gras recipes, New Orleans food, it's really rich in dairy products and meat products. In the early church, and the Eastern Orthodox still keep this fast, not only was meat forbidden, but all dairy products were forbidden. Anything that came from an animal was forbidden. So you get, also in England, Shrove Tuesday with all the pancakes. Why pancakes? Why all this fat and butter? For the same reason. They're getting rid of all this before Lent.
Okay, fat and butter and pancakes. I'm liking this already. This is a great interview. I'm learning so much stuff here. Moving through the liturgical calendar, though, after Lent, obviously the next big stop is Easter. So, and I guess the Pentecost as well. So anything traditionally related to alcohol and Easter and the Pentecost?
I couldn't find a great deal. There are various blessings for wine on Easter. You have a sort of tie-in with the Passover. But Easter, Ascension, Pentecost is much more various. And so for those seasons especially, I supplemented them with a lot of drink suggestions of my own.
Aha! There you go. You are making history, not just reporting history.
Well, I'm trying to contribute to the tradition.
Oh, well, that's great. Traditions always have to start somewhere, and they might be starting right here in this book.
That's right.
In terms of the liturgical calendar, I guess once we come up to Pentecost, there's kind of a dry spell, I would guess, for a couple months. Is there anything to fill out those summer months and such?
Well, this is why the saints' days are so important.
Mm-hmm.
They're there for almost every day of the year, and they provide sort of anchoring for the celebration of the year.
And that leads me to the next major section of your book, which deals with saint days and alcohol. And now we have had a guest on our show several times, Brian O'Neill, one of my favorite guests, who has written quite a bit about saints, saints that many people don't know, as well as saints for different months of the year. And we've had interviews with him on the saints of January and the saints of February. And while I don't want to necessarily step on his toes, we are here at the beginning of May. Your book is coming out in May, and it's actually coming out tomorrow, as and people can go find that on various websites. Tell us about some of the drinks associated with saints, but maybe perhaps anchor this to the month of May so people can celebrate these as they listen to the podcast.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned the book launch on May 4th. There are two saints actually associated with May 4th. One is Saint Monica, the mother of Saint Augustine. She lived a life that had a great deal of sorrow, but also joy. She watched her son sort of live a riotous life, leave the faith, but then come back spectacularly and become a great saint. And she also was married to a really hot-tempered, philandering man that she eventually was able to convert to Christianity as well. So for St. Monica, we have a drink called the Merry Widow. Mm. It's a rather unusual cocktail. It has gin and dry vermouth and Benedictine and absinthe, which is an anise-based spirit.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that one that's traditional, or is this one that you made up?
I did not make up the Merry Widow. It's an old cocktail, though. It's probably from around the late 19th, early 20th century. So it's sort of a vintage cocktail.
But as I understand it in the reading of your book, you don't just rely upon some traditional ones, but you take some saints and you give them their own drinks. And you do that in the month of May. So tell us a little bit about this.
Absolutely. I have a couple of original cocktails for the month of May. One is for, on May 10th, Father Damien, St. Damien of Molokai. This is the priest who very famously ministered to a leper colony in Hawaii, and we wanted to give him a special cocktail in his honor. We didn't want to name it after lepers, though. That didn't sound
doesn't sound too appealing.
So we do have a drink that we just simply called the St. Damien, and each of the ingredients in the drink allegorically sort of ties into his life.
Okay.
So the main ingredient is London gin.
Okay, so hang on here. I'm going to do this along with you. You're going to give us the recipe. And now, if I understand you're correctly, there are about 350 recipes in this book?
That is correct. About 350 cocktail recipes, yep.
And about 30 of them are your own creation.
That's correct.
And this is one of them. So go ahead and tell us about the Saint Damien.
Okay, so we got the Saint Damien with 1 ounce of gin.
Okay, hang on here. Okay, 1 ounce of gin. Here we go. Okay.
and that's to represent his dominion, or the British dominion over the Hawaiian Islands at the time that he was alive.
Okay.
You've also got 3/4 ounce of pineapple juice.
Okay, I'll get some of that over here. Okay, there, we got a splash of that, I guess. 3/4 ounce, not a lot. That's just a splash.
Just a splash, okay. And that represents the Hawaiian Islands.
Okay.
1/4 ounce of grenadine.
Okay, here we go.
And
oops, that's a little bit... Oh, well, that's all right.
Grenadine is made from pomegranate, which in Christian art is a symbol of self-giving. And then lastly, to represent the bitterness of leprosy, 1/4 ounce of lemon juice.
Okay, I got some of that here prepared. And just 1/4 ounce, just a little splash again there. All right, okay, there we have it. And now how am I supposed to take, I'm looking around at my desk here. I got a pen. Should I just stir this with a pen?
Well, ideally you would put it in a shaker filled with ice and shake it 40 times.
Aha. See, that is one of the other cool things that I learned in this book. Your mixology and theology, I guess, is kind of blending in here together. And I found this fascinating that you can either stir or shake a drink. That's the old famous James Bond thing. Mm-hmm. You tend to prefer shaken drinks and 40 times. Explain this a little bit.
Well, I do prefer shaking it just as sort of a general practice, although there are strengths and weaknesses to either arrangement. When you shake a drink, it dilutes the strength a little bit, so that can be a good thing or a bad thing. The reason why you would shake or stir either is you want your cocktail to be very, very cold. It's a cold cocktail that enhances the flavor of the drink. Warm gin can be like turpentine, so you want your drink to have a nice cold temperature. And you can do that by shaking. I recommend 40 times. It's a good biblical number, has a nice penitential air to it. You can also stir a drink until it's very cold. Either way.
Okay. And stirring a drink gives it a different flavor, doesn't it? I mean, I never really understood this.
That's right. The neat thing about stirring is that it's less diluted, so it's going to be a stronger flavor, a more concentrated drink. It also gives the drink a sort of thick, syrupy quality to it. Whereas when you shake the drink, it's a little more diluted by water, and you see these beautiful little ice shards that float on top of the drink. So they're both good. It all depends on personal preference.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book, that the ice gives it a magical flavor. The ice shards are both visually appealing, but also kind of lends a little bit to the flavor.
Exactly. And if you don't want a super strong martini, you want it dry, but you don't want it extremely concentrated, then shaken and not stirred would be the way to go.
Okay. Well, that is pretty cool. I always take my whiskey with one chip of ice or a drop of an ice cube because it tends to release the flavor, and it does really interesting things. So there are some magical properties to all of these alcohols. Let me go ahead and press you for one other. So there are 30 recipes that you've made up on your own. We don't want to reveal all those because we want to point people back to the book. You gave us the Saint Damien. Give us another. Do you have another one from the month of May related to a saint?
I do. Coming up on May 16th is the feast of Saint Brendan the Navigator. This is the Irish monk that some people think discovered the New World a good several hundred years before Christopher Columbus. There are these legends about St. Brendan and his monk companions sailing into the Western Atlantic and discovering all kinds of strange places, including an island of the blessed. And so in honor of these traditions, we made a cocktail called St. Brendan's Isle. Mm-hmm. And its main ingredient, fittingly enough, is a liqueur named after St. Brendan's, made in Ireland, St. Brendan's liqueur.
So what is this St. Brendan's liqueur?
It is an Irish cream liqueur. There are several on the market, and this happens to be one of them. It's a sort of creamy alcohol drink. It could be enjoyed neat. Usually it's enjoyed over the rocks, but we have it in a cocktail.
So give us the recipe.
Okay. It is 1.5 ounces of vanilla-flavored vodka.
Okay. There you go. Vanilla-flavored vodka. Now, I don't have vanilla-flavored vodka. Is that okay?
Regular vodka is okay, too.
Okay, but vanilla flavor would be better. But, okay, there we go.
1 ounce of coffee liqueur, like Kahlua.
Okay, let me get pop that bottle open. Coffee flavor. I always love coffee-flavored liqueur. You can't go wrong with coffee either.
No.
So you got to write a book on coffee and religion here. Okay, there we go. Coffee a little bit of that in there.
And 3/4 of an ounce of St. Brendan's.
Okay. That one, I'm not going to be able to finish that drink because I don't have that. I'm going to have to go to the store.
There you go.
Okay.
And you also will then have a little milk. And what you do is build all these ingredients in an old-fashioned glass filled with crushed ice, and then you top with milk and stir.
Now that is daring. Milk, really?
Oh, absolutely.
Hmm.
There are a lot of cocktails that have some milk in it.
And so when you first serve this to some of your friends, I mean, I'm sure you've had your research guinea pigs there, you pour the milk in there and they look at you and go, I mean, I would have done that.
Well, especially after dinner, it's a really good drink.
Yeah, I can imagine. It has that ice creamy flavor to it, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I guess that would be really good. You mentioned the glass, too. Old-fashioned glass, and there's martini glasses. Do the glasses matter at all for this stuff?
They very much do. So usually when people think of a cocktail, they think of a cocktail glass, which is also called a martini glass. That's the one with the long stem and the sort of cone-shaped bowl. The reason for that shape is that it's to keep the drink as cold as possible. All the liquid goes in that bowl, but your hand is on that long stem away from the bowl, so your hand is not warming up the drink. It's designed to keep the drink cold.
Absolutely fascinating. See all the stuff, the cool stuff you learn here on Research on Religion. The relationship to the saints, the what glasses to use, how to pour it in the shake or stir. This stuff is really good. I have to ask you one other question, though, and this takes us a little bit away from alcohol, but you wrote another book called Why Do Catholics Eat Fish on Friday? And I know when I contacted you to get you on the podcast with this new exciting book, I said, hey, can I ask that question too? And you said, oh, we really want to, you know, talk about the new book, and Regnery wants us to talk about that. So I altered the question a little bit. And let me ask this. Why do Catholics eat beer-battered fish on Friday?
Wow, good question. Although it is a trick question.
It is.
We Catholics don't necessarily have to eat fish on Friday.
Oh.
The tradition was not that you had to eat fish on Friday. The tradition was that you had to abstain from flesh meat on Friday. And so if you wanted, you could, you know, eat pasta, meatless pasta on that day and fulfill the requirement. But as it turns out, a lot of Catholics did end up eating fish on Friday, and that's where that association stuck.
Right, this seems like a little sneaky roundabout way of getting around that requirement. I mean, fish are fleshy too, right?
Well, the distinction that the church makes is that you abstain from the flesh of a warm-blooded animal.
Oh.
And that means, so no beef, no poultry, no pork, but reptiles you could eat. If you wanted frog legs or alligator on Friday, go for it.
Hmm.
But the distinction was the flesh of a warm-blooded animal.
And the religious reference there being?
Well, there are a lot of theories as to why that is. My personal theory is that it ties into the symbolism of the day. That just as every Sunday is a mini Easter, every Friday is a mini Good Friday. It's a day of sorrow where you remember our Lord's sacrifice for us. And so on that day, you abstain from the flesh of an animal that shed its blood for you, so to speak, as a sort of backward way of remembering the God who shed his blood for you.
Hmm. Again, something very fascinating that I had not really realized. And so the stuff that I learn on this podcast is just absolutely fascinating. And not only fascinating, but fun, because the book that you wrote is a very fun book. There's a lot of trivia things that you can impress your friends with. As we mentioned, there are some recipes in here as well. But you also wrote this book for some serious scholarly reasons as well. And let me go ahead and finish our podcast with this question. If you had a main message that you wanted every reader to take away from this book, Drinking with the Saints, what would that be?
I guess it would be, it is okay to enjoy the goodness of God's creation in moderation. And it's okay to enjoy that goodness in company with friends on both sides of the grave. You know, thanks to the resurrection, death has no dominion over Christ's church. And so we are still in communion, not only with the people around us, but with the Christians who have gone before us. And we should celebrate that. The communion of saints is a reminder of Christ's victory over death.
And that is a wonderful way to end off our podcast. And another way would be to bring up one of the many toasts that you mentioned throughout the book, and that is ad multos annos, which means?
Many years. God grant you many years.
Many good years to come. Well, Mike Foley, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion, and many good years to you.
And to you as well, Tony. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.